Hi, everyone, and welcome to Between Two Chambers. I'm Andrew Griffin, your host and Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at the Maryland Chamber of Commerce.
And I'm Hannah Allen, Government Affairs Associate here at the Chamber. Here we are kicking off Season 3, Episode 1. And in today's episode, we're going to unpack the Maryland Chamber of Commerce's legislative priorities for the upcoming 2024 session.
This session, the Chamber has identified a robust set of issues addressing the core concerns of the business community. From navigating the fiscal challenges the state faces to long-term transportation funding solutions and comprehensive data privacy legislation, our state is at a crossroads. We'll also explore military retiree relief, aiming to retain our veterans' valuable expertise, and the importance of increasing affordable childcare options to help tackle Maryland's workforce challenge. So here it is, the Maryland Chamber's 2024 legislative priorities. Good afternoon, everybody. It's December 4th right now. And that puts us a little bit over a month away from the start of the 2024 Maryland General Assembly session.
Yep.
Last week, we released our legislative priorities. The Chamber released our legislative priorities and critical issues document. So I thought we would just take a little bit of time today to kind of run over what those top five priorities for the 24 session are. And hit on maybe some other smaller items, but just so people know, hey, what's top of mind for the business community going into 2024?
Yeah, I'll say that we have had a really busy interim just working on regulatory actions involved in different commissions. Mm-hmm. I think this legislative session will be particularly busy. But all of our priorities are really centered around competitiveness, how we can attract and retain business in Maryland, and make it a more competitive state. So let's get into them.
Yeah. And I think before we jump in, for the folks listening, I think what's important is how does the Chamber arrive to these items, right? This is all every year. These priorities are totally member driven. They filter up from our policy committees. Every single member of the Chamber can participate in one of our 10 policy committees, and they, kind of give recommendations on what's top of mind for the business community that filters up to our legislative committee, right, who really kind of gives that final rubber stamp and looks at the strategic overall view of the Chamber's advocacy. So very much member driven. And, this is what we're hearing from the business community, big and small. So I think it's really important.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're flipping through the document, and hopefully if you haven't had a chance to look at it, you can find it on our website. Certainly our members have received it in an email, but on our social media, you should be able to find it. If you flip through really on those first couple pages, you'll see 1 through 5, and I think we'll just kind of run down these items here. And Hannah, I think first, we just put business taxes here, right? And I think so much of this session is going to be about the budget. It's really kind of dominating the headlines right now. The state is, although I think immediately not in a budget crisis, but I think through fiscal year 28, so really the next 5 years, the budget situation is precarious for the state. And not only just for, standard operating and capital, but the Transportation Trust Fund. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the state has bitten off a lot in the blueprint and education funding. And so there's a lot there. So here we've highlighted business taxes as a top issue for the business community. The reality is so often when the legislature convenes and the budget is not what they need, right? Yeah. What do? It's the business community that tends to be the biggest guy in the room always. And so when they need revenue, they look at us. And I think it's just really important, as we're going to have a conversation about some of these items over and over again, that, we kind of understand where Maryland falls kind of in the tax world. And where we compare to our neighbors, right? I mean, I think as it stands, we're not, the corporate tax rate of 8.25% is not the highest in the region, but Pennsylvania obviously is above ours currently, but they are on a plan to lower it.
Yeah, down to 4.99%.
Over 10 years, I think it is a phase down. And they really had kind of been the highest for the 9.99, I think they were. Mm-hmm. And then I think even if you kind of stretch out that region a little bit more to New Jersey, I think they had a temporary surcharge on their corporate tax rate, which expired, and they didn't re-up it. And so I think even their rate is competitive with ours. And so I think when we think holistically, where's money going to come from? Doing something as simple as raising a rate, we talk about regional economic competitiveness. We're already kind of up there. We're the highest number around. And so certainly it's not going to be popular to go higher. I mean, I don't know what your thoughts are there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the governor and the General Assembly are really going to have to strike a balance between generating revenue and also enhancing our economic competitiveness, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, we want to have a competitive tax climate in Maryland so we can, again, attract businesses here. And you're looking at states like Virginia and New Jersey, you mentioned, Pennsylvania. Like, we're, with our surrounding states, we are going to soon be sticking out like a sore thumb. Mm-hmm. And we are at a point where we're going to have the highest corporate income tax rate in the area.
Yeah.
So it's definitely something top of mind for us. You know, we, again, like see the legislature look at businesses and corporations first. I think combined reporting is something that's top of mind for us. It's something that the legislature has debated for years and years and years. But with our looming budget deficit that's expected to hit in fiscal year 25, I think it's going to be a little bit of a bigger conversation for us this year, and something we'll be paying close attention to for sure.
Yeah, no, combined reporting is, you know, I'm glad you mentioned it. It's something I think, I don't know if the stat is true or not, but I have heard it said that it's been introduced every single year in the General Assembly since 1983, mm-hmm. Has never been passed. It is kind of funny, right? It has never been passed, but every single time, you know, there is this need for revenue, it seems to be that advocates dust off this idea that combined reporting is a silver bullet to bring bucket loads of money to the state.
Yeah.
You know, the statistics nationwide for the states that have adopted combined reporting just certainly don't prove that out, right? Most states, they don't see any increase in revenue.
Yeah.
You know, interestingly, we brought up New Jersey, a combined reporting state, and I think that there is going to be a push there. I know, in fact, that there's going to be a push there to roll back big components of their combined reporting law, because it has led to no increase in revenue for them, and it is identified as a major deterrent to business investment. And so I just find that interesting. You know, none of our surrounding states have combined reporting, but certainly continue to put us at an economic disadvantage when we're competing so much so with Pennsylvania and Virginia. And I think, you know, it's not only it's a bad scheme in bad economic times. And I think that that's a huge, where we sit at the end of 2023, while we're waiting for the other shoe to drop potentially on a economic recession, I think the expectation is that there will be one. It doesn't seem wise to make a corporate tax change that is going to potentially lower your revenue.
Yeah.
You know, and interestingly, Minnesota in their last legislative session, they currently have what's called water's edge combined reporting. They chose to not go to worldwide combined reporting. And, you know, Minnesota, obviously, interestingly, both of these states similar politically to Maryland. They chose not to go to worldwide combined reporting because I think it was the chair of the Ways and Means Committee there said that the revenue is not reliable enough. It is too volatile.
Right.
That they need to build roads and bridges like we need to build roads and bridges here, and they can't guarantee the revenue. And so it doesn't seem like a wise.
Yeah, I think that's something that we've definitely seen just through studies or looking at what other states have done. Mm-hmm. It has not shown to provide the reliable revenue that the states are typically looking for. And I think it sends the opposite message that Maryland wants to be competitive if that was something that were to pass. And it, you know, definitely puts the governor and his administration in an interesting position as well, because he has had such a focus on bringing new business here and keeping them here. So I think that would put him in quite an interesting situation.
Yep. Yeah, and so often, right, businesses, especially when you're trying to attract new business, what do they want? They want regulatory certainty.
Right.
And when you introduce combined reporting into the mix, what do you not get?
That's quite certainty. The opposite of that.
Yeah, you don't get certainty.
Right.
I think the other item on I'll just kind of put the pin in on business taxes is, you know, anything, you know, with government, it's such a difficult conversation because they're delivering services and things for people that, you know, the constituency wants, but is it being delivered in a responsible way? And I think that that's always the trade-off. If you need revenue, the people are going to want to see that you're also being a responsible steward of that money. And so I think people are going to be watching is the General Assembly making responsible cuts to the budget, right? Are they like you and me and everybody else that you can't spend more than you make? And I think that that's the difficult situation is there's going to be some compromise. And so we'll wait to see. Definitely. Certainly we're going to advocate that there be responsible cuts if there's going to be a call for revenue. Certainly you mm-hmm. can't have it all.
Yeah. And you had mentioned transportation funding, obviously mm-hmm. the budget deficit that we're expected to see in the coming handful of years. Transportation funding is a big one. You know, we see the gas tax dwindling. We have more electric vehicle adoption, you know, with the adoption of California's Advanced Clean Cars 2 rule. We're really seeing the state push and incentivize electric vehicle adoption, mm-hmm. which obviously takes away from people contributing to the gas tax, which is largely contributing to the Transportation Trust Fund. So I think we can talk a little bit about that as well. That's another big priority that the chamber is going to be focused on this yep. year.
Yeah. So we were lucky enough, certainly for those of you listening, Mary, the chamber's president and CEO, was appointed to the, we call it Train Commission, Transportation, Revenue
and Infrastructure Needs.
And Infrastructure Investment Needs.
Yes, correct.
There we go. she was appointed to the Train Commission, which was really charged with looking at, really two buckets, right? It's how do we sustainably fund transportation projects in the state, the Transportation Trust Fund, and then how do we better prioritize transportation projects right. in the state? And I think on the latter, from the chamber's perspective, prioritization is not that big of an issue. For the business community, the projects need to get built, right?
Right.
Whether the project is in Charles County or Baltimore City, doesn't matter as much for us. We need to move people and goods as efficiently as possible. And so we need it all built and we need it funded to get right. built. And so they met for this interim, and I think their work will continue for another year through 2024. But I think they're meeting next week, right, to
right.
vote on kind of like a set of recommendations for the 24 session.
Right.
And I think of the three draft recommendations we've seen so far, two of them are funding based and then one is prioritization based.
Right.
So,
and I think those recommendations really will just open up the door for more discussion and kind of diving a little bit deeper on those topics mm-hmm. and on those recommendations in 2024. You know, it's hard to say if the legislature will really do too much coming out of the Train Commission recommendations yeah. this session. I'm sure there will be some bills, of course, transportation focused. But I really think in the 2025 session, with the final set of recommendations that they put out at the end of next year, it will, you know, that'll be our time to shine and our time to really figure out a sustainable funding source to the TTF, which
yeah.
we heavily rely on for these projects, like you mentioned.
Yeah. And so of the three recommendations that I think we're expecting them to vote on, as I don't know what the final outcome will be at this point, but we know that the first one is providing for registration fees for electric mm-hmm. vehicles. The second is dealing with tolls. And I think, you know, really that just means potentially raising tolls.
Right.
And then for the third is for the Department of Transportation to come up with a new prioritization process,
yep.
more or less, for projects to get completed in, around the state. And so, you know, for the chamber, obviously we're going to be supportive, need to be supportive of long-term sustainable funding mm-hmm. solutions because, you can't, if you talk to a business in anywhere, certainly in the Capital Region or the Baltimore Region, or if you ask an employee who lives in Hagerstown and maybe works in D.C., or someone who lives in Queen Anne's County and works in Anne Arundel County and they drive over the Bay Bridge every single day, or you live in Charles County right in your community in D.C.,
right.
I mean, no one is going to say that they can get to work effectively and efficiently.
Oh, yeah.
And certainly no one is going to say, yeah, moving goods around the state
mm-hmm.
we've got a great system. And so it's literally a business imperative almost that we fix. If we want this region to remain competitive, we have to do something about the transportation network.
Right. I mean, Maryland has the worst traffic congestion in the country. We have some of the worst road conditions, and the longest commuting time. So it's one of the worst states to be driving a car in, and commuting to work. People don't want to drive to work every day when they're in hours of traffic. So it's definitely a big issue for us. I think we'll see different ideas discussed, more specific ideas this upcoming year in the 2024 session and in the train commission meetings. You know, it could be vehicle miles traveled fee on electric vehicles. There's been a lot of discussion about pairing up electric vehicles with, you know, our gas-powered vehicles and making sure that there's fair fees charged on either end. Because right now they're not paying any sort of fees that go into TTF that are substantial.
Yeah.
So that'll be important too. I know a few days ago, interestingly, we saw the Moore administration is proposing to tackle the long-term budget deficit by imposing, I think, up to like $2 billion in cuts on transportation projects. It would result in a stop to a lot of maintenance, you know, on roads and bridges and even like transit construction, which I know this administration has had a big focus on. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But that just circles back to the idea of pretty much every discussion that we're having that I feel like we've been having and every policy issue we think about, it all comes back to the budget and where the budget is. You know, that's the bigger picture. So more to come.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, I think this is something, and all, you know, all things come in waves. I think transportation for Maryland and for the greater, you know, region, the Mid-Atlantic region, is like, this is a huge one for us. Because the infrastructure is just not doing well. And if we want this region, just the way the population is spread out, and it's got to work, or we're going to take ourselves out of the running. I mean, you're seeing what some states like North Carolina, South Carolina has totally revamped how they're investing in transportation. I mean, they're to bring themselves on par to be competitive. We're going to need to do something.
Yeah.
So walk through one and two. The third item for us, really a priority, is data privacy. Which I get a lot of questions, interesting, like, oh, the chamber, you guys are really involved in data privacy. What's that about? Which we've been involved in data privacy. The discussion around how private industry collects and uses customer data, basically. Right. And we've been involved in this discussion the last 4 or 5 years. There's been, I wouldn't call it a push, but there has been a focus on this policy in the legislature for the last 4 or 5 years. And so, I mean, I think how private institutions handle people's data is a really important issue, not only from the customer perspective, right, of they want to protect their data that you can't, you know, it's your personal data. You can't get a new anything else. And so certainly that makes sense. And from the company perspective, they want to be responsible users of data as well. And so I think where we sit now, I think there's like a dozen states, 12,
it's 13, maybe 13, I think,
states, that have passed data privacy legislation, basically governing how private entities collect, use, and use people's data. And so
It's in Delaware and Virginia, our two of our surrounding states, our neighboring states. But legislation, data privacy legislation, has been introduced in, I think, like 25 states at this point.
Yeah.
However, it's creating some confusion for businesses, especially businesses that operate in multiple states, because the laws are all different. You know, every state wants to have their own special law. But it's, I think we're really going to be focused on not having a confusing patchwork approach to data privacy legislation, which we are currently seeing. And I think we need to make sure Maryland's on par with some of our neighboring states and some of the states where we've seen really good legislation come from. You know, we need to look at those states and see what's gone wrong and what's working really well for them and pull from that. I think there's a lot already out there that we can pull from. So we'll definitely be advocating for that this session.
Yep. And I think something as interconnected, right, as how people are interacting on a web-based platform, online shopping, whatever it is, as interconnected that is, it certainly weaves across a made-up state border. And so having 50 different patchworks of laws is just obviously not ideal. Yeah. And so I think if we can look at, like you mentioned, our surrounding neighbors, what's worked, what maybe hasn't worked, I think we're kind of at a point now where we can make some really informed decisions. And I think we'll continue to advocate for the things that we think work well and the things that we don't, that don't work well, right? I think the worst case scenario being that 2007 Illinois biometrics law that, you know, has just been an absolute nightmare for the business community out there.
Overall, like taking a step back, I think it would be most ideal to have a national data privacy law.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So it's equal across all 50 states, and it provides clear a clear set of rules no matter where you're located or where you're doing business.
Yep.
But again, I think if not a national law, we need to analyze what other states have done and what's worked really well and use the models from other states that have already passed and already been in, you know, been set forth in law for years now. But I think the focus on data privacy will be bigger than past years. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a big focus on AI, and I think data privacy is just a stepping stone to responsible AI. I'm sure we will see some AI bills introduced this year. We saw a few last year that were really just, you know, studies, but we might see some bigger pushes towards AI, and that's kind of where we need a solid and clear data privacy law kind of before we move forward with that too.
Yep. Nope. Absolutely. We're always ready to move on to the next biggest thing without like adequately addressing the first item, which is I think this kind of data privacy before AI situation is a perfect example of that.
Yeah. And speaking of like a patchwork approach, in 2022, the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation released an evaluation on the cost of compliance in a 50-state patchwork system of privacy laws, of data privacy laws. The cost of compliance for Maryland was estimated at $4.2 billion. So I think that in itself is a strong argument to find, you know, similarities with these other states and policy adoption to not have a patchwork approach. But we'll see what the legislature ultimately decides.
Yeah, yeah. I would think that, you know, just kind of knowing the process in Annapolis, we've seen legislation on this issue the last handful of years. You kind of would expect it to come to a head eventually. And so I think for the business community out there listening, you know, I think a statewide data privacy law kind of governing how you're collecting and using someone's data is going to come sooner rather than later, I think.
And overall, I think employers and residents and consumers want and deserve certain privacy protections, of course, but it does need to be done in a way that works for business and that keeps businesses operating successfully. But speaking of data privacy, you know, data centers comes to mind, of course. Mm-hmm. Maryland's really shaping up to be a leading state where data centers want to locate. They want to locate here. We have a lot of tech companies. We're neighbors with DC. We have qualified talent. We have modern infrastructure. We have like special incentives to get data centers to locate here. So, but it's interesting. We had a large or have a large data center project being built here. But a recent PSC decision not to provide a full CPCN exemption so they can have diesel backup generation resulted in the project no longer moving forward.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we're really just getting in our own way of attracting data centers to our state, and not to completely pivot from data privacy, but I just think that was something that, you know, we could mention and talk about.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I think just history on kind of the economic development and the data center industry here in Maryland, you know, the chamber played a big role in helping to advocate for some economic development legislation to frankly try to become competitive with Virginia, which is kind of a data center industry gone like run amok almost. To us, we were just kind of, you know, looking at, hey, these are coming into communities, really investing in communities in areas that need it, using up in some instances using commercial space that was not being utilized, providing property tax revenue in areas that didn't have it before, and so, you know, bringing high paying jobs, high quality jobs. So these are instances that we were like, hey, you know, it almost is like Virginia was running out of room. It's Loudoun mm-hmm. County is a data center, basically. And so if where it makes sense for the local governments to who want to go ahead and attract that, we thought, hey, this is a great thing to do. And so in 2020, we advocated to pass a sales and use tax bill on data center equipment, and which successfully passed. And great, the project you're talking about mm-hmm. really kind of came out of that.
Right.
It's unfortunate to see a lot of hard work done to attract an industry and all the positives that
money
can potentially
invested.
Come with it.
Yeah.
Money invested to, you know, then see a decision from an appointed body basically take the legs out from underneath a potential project. And so it's certainly a data center may not be right for every community or every locality, and but it should be up to the local government to decide whether or not they want them located there mm-hmm. and to just say, oh, no, we're not going to do it based off of backup generation in the case of an emergency, you know, is kind of silly. So hopefully, you know, I think if anything's going to be done, it's got to be done this session to address the issue. You don't want anything to get too stale. Obviously, one company has already walked away from a project and an investment, which is really unfortunate. All right. Data privacy, data centers. What is next? Number four, military
shifting
retirement.
Gears. Yep. Shifting gears to military retirement relief. This will be a critical issue for us. You know, we want to incentivize, we want to retain our veterans in their talent here in Maryland. I think Maryland's currently facing a little bit of a brain drain as military retirees look for other opportunities outside of Maryland. You know, they've currently filled gaps in our workforce, like in important industries like IT, healthcare, cybersecurity, defense. And we continue to fall behind our neighboring states when it comes to attracting and retaining our military retirees. You know, Maryland is one of 15 states that doesn't offer a total income tax exemption on military retirement income. Virginia just passed a bill where they are going to phase out over the next couple years their income tax exemption. It'll go up to $440,000 by 2025. West Virginia, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, other surrounding states of ours are already fully, they've already fully exempted military retirement income. So we really need to get on board with the bulk of the country, frankly, which fully exempts retired pay for military personnel.
It's a great point. And I think the question we get so often is, why just military retirement income? Mm-hmm. And why not, you know, oh, I worked in the private sector. Why should my retirement income also be exempt from income tax? And I think it's a good question. I think we need to look at it from a workforce issue, certainly. First off, Maryland has an outside concentration of military installations, right? Mm-hmm. So I think we just end up with a ton of veterans here locally. I mean, we have... I think it's five of the mega installations, right? Mm-hmm. And so what's interesting about military retirees compared to other retirees is someone who's done their time in the military and has taken early retirement is probably, what, 50?
Oh, yeah.
55?
I would say 30s to early 50s is when we see them retiring, depending on what rank they are or what their position is.
And so let's say if you retired in your early 50s, you've got what, 10, 15 more years potentially
20,
left of a career that you may go and take a second job. Another job. You may start your own company. You may do all these things that, you know, unfortunately, because everyone around us has been aggressive in attracting people taking, you know, veterans taking retirement, and Maryland has just remained stagnant. Mm-hmm. We're letting a critical component of the workforce just walk away. And why are they such a critical component to the workforce? I mean, the jobs that we see, the industry we see growing the fastest is what? It's cyber, it's computer, mm-hmm. it's computer science and technology, it's IT, it's intelligence, it's any of the various and sundry government contracting sector mm-hmm. that, I mean, those, that is literally a segment of the workforce with the exact skills you need walking to somewhere else because they can get a better bang for their buck somewhere else. And we have such a tight workforce. What the October rates, October unemployment rate in Maryland was, yes, what, 1.7%?
1.7.
0.1% up from the national historic low of 1.6%. You need every possible worker you can get.
Oh, yeah.
And so, to be honest, they're offering military retirees, or they're offering something unique. They're offering unique skills. They're offering another 10, 15, 20 years of work. Mm-hmm. And they're choosing to go somewhere else to have that second career. And they're taking their families with them because, you know, Virginia or Delaware are being more aggressive in how they treat income. And so,
right,
I think the challenge has been and always will be getting over that initial hump of we're losing revenue right now, as versus the 10 or 15 year investment of that person staying here and spending money. So,
yeah. And these are highly skilled workers, yeah, again, working in those higher paying jobs, like you just mentioned. And I think we have like 20 or so military facilities supporting military intelligence, cybersecurity, yeah, all those important industries that you mentioned. And we're in the top 10 for total defense spending at $26.4 billion. We rank number six in the nation. And the number of defense personnel, which is almost 94,000 people, which is number eight in the nation. So we are poised to we're in an interesting position where we could really attract and keep our military retirees here and benefit. Like, think about the benefit. They go and take a job after retiring from the military. Mm-hmm. You're getting that income tax money, and then their spouse is also working, and you're getting their income tax money. Or they can just pick up and move their family to a more friendly state to, know, get their next job in or retire in.
Yep. And I think, you know, the reason that this is in the chamber's top priorities is obviously not only workforce. It's not only we want to continue to retain veterans who are, you know, critical members of the community, but I think, you know, our hat goes off to Governor Moore, who mm-hmm. introduced a military retirement tax bill yeah. in his first session as governor, you know, was able to get across the finish line. Certainly we would all have loved to be more aggressive and have a bigger impact. But I think to his credit, he kind of got the ball rolling on this discussion that we need to be doing more and we can be doing more. Right. And so, I think, you know, now's the time that we need to be beating the drum and it's certainly going to pay off, I think, for the private sector, if we can get something done here in the next couple of years, big time, particularly in workforce.
Right. Yeah. So I think for this upcoming session, we'll really be pushing to fully exempt the state income tax on military retirement pay.
Yep.
Likely a phased in approach would be most responsible, but that's something that's going to be top of mind, especially thinking of workforce. And just kind of moving into our last top priority, which is childcare availability and affordability. That's something that the chamber has had a focus on for many years. This was a top priority for us last year as well. We supported some bills, you know, to help with childcare availability. But ultimately, this is a workforce development issue. This is something that I think we'll continue to see interest in from the legislature. The COVID-19 pandemic really exacerbated the childcare shortage in Maryland, yep. Yep. and we haven't seen it rebound. We haven't seen it pick back up since then. That industry is really struggling, which has led to a negative impact on workers' ability to participate in the labor market. It's really a contributing factor to a worker's decision to go back to the workforce after having been off. You know, if a mother or a father, whoever is the primary, you know, childcare person at a family, if they are paying more for childcare every month than they're receiving in their salary or their pay, they're obviously going to stay home and not participate in the right. labor market. So yep. I think that'll continue to be a big focus for us.
Yeah, I think we've seen, obviously we know childcare availability is a, you know, it affects both, you know, mothers and fathers, but it is a women in the workforce issue. Mm-hmm. We've not seen women return to the workforce in the numbers, pre-COVID numbers. The loss of slots statewide because of COVID really contributed to price increases, which mm-hmm. has priced people out of then being able to send their kids to childcare, like you mentioned. Certainly, I know it all too well with one and a half year old and a second one on the way. Right. Childcare is not, it is not cheap. And so what can the chamber, what can the private industry be doing to help support, right? Help to increase that availability, mm-hmm. which should take some stress and pressure off the increase in price. And so We've supported, like you mentioned, we've supported legislation to help deal with capital costs up front. We know the number one barrier to a new childcare facility opening up is capital costs. And so we've supported some grant programs at the Department of Commerce to address that. Last year, we supported a bill to exempt facilities for back to the veterans and military, for on-base and in-home childcare facilities of just the children of active military from state accreditation, because there's no reason that need to receive both federal accreditation, which is more stringent than Maryland's rules and regulations when they've already met, you know, they don't need two forms of accreditation. And so just what can we do around the edges to, you know, and then incentivize private industry to kind of get involved, right? Utilize some of the available commercial space.
People do employee working from benefits. Home is leaving more and more space available in these buildings that these larger companies own or rent. So take advantage of that.
And we've seen, you know, other states be creative in that, you know, some companies have decided to give stipends or help their, as part of a benefits, employee benefits package, help with childcare costs. And some states have been creative and said, well, you know, if you give a stipend for childcare, that's tax-free, that's income tax-free. So that they're keeping more of those dollars to spend on childcare. And so we think that there's some room here to get creative. That's not just more government spending all the time. I mean, so often that is just seen as the answer, but you can certainly incentivize private industry to get involved, and we certainly want to see that.
Yeah, and it's, again, I'll beat the drum, it's not just a family issue, it's a workforce issue, right? Yep. Our members consistently express concerns about the challenges of attracting skilled workers to meet their needs. And despite our highly educated workforce, I think we do struggle to retain talent. We lose workers to other states with better education opportunities or workforce development programs or, you know, possibly better childcare options out there. So access to childcare options at a more affordable price allows people to go back to work and to stay in Maryland.
Yep. All right. So we've hit the top five. That's number five, right? So paying attention to the budget and the tax situation. Mm-hmm. We're going to have transportation related issues, which, you know, I think that's going to be a theme for the next handful of years. We think data privacy, in my opinion, data privacy is probably going to come to a head this year or next, kind of pushing and starting to beat the drum on some level of retirement relief. In this instance, you know, we're really advocating for military retirees. And then continuing to work on the difficult situation that is kind of the childcare environment to see what we can do to increase the available slots and help with affordability. What else do we think? I know you mentioned, we mentioned kind of the data center situation as a specific one. What else do we see as kind of an issue for this session that the business community is going to be paying attention to?
Well, I think meeting our climate goals is something that Maryland is strong on. We're up there with California, and really having the most ambitious greenhouse gas reduction goals in the country. And that falls on businesses' backs too. We've seen legislation introduced, which I'm sure we will continue to see introduced, that really tries to quote unquote hold businesses accountable, you know, for their carbon emissions. And I think we'll still be paying attention to bills like that. But just, I think taking a step back and looking at a bigger view of the Climate Solutions Now Act that passed in 2022 created a lot of commissions and workforces. It, you know, created new regulatory action, which we saw through the building energy performance standards regulations that MDE put forward this summer that we're expecting to see soon in the Maryland Register. That's something that we were actively involved in. And also the Climate Pathway Report, that final report is supposed to be out by the end of this year. So hopefully in the next couple of weeks, by the end of December, we see the updated modeling from UMD and we kind of see the finalized policies that they recommend Maryland push forward with. Again, in the draft report, there were a lot of ambitious policies that touched on every industry and sector throughout the state. You had your transportation, buildings, electricity, manufacturing, all that good stuff, statewide carbon tax. And I think, you know, it was interesting to read the report and realize, well, this is one singular pathway to meet our climate goals, and you'd have to meet all of them perfectly to hit that 60% reduction by 2031. So I think the legislature could potentially take some of those and make them their own, those recommendations, make some tweaks to existing law. But I think that's something that will continue to need to be addressed, especially with tight timelines. 2031 is not far away.
Yeah.
The proposals result in billions of dollars, which the state doesn't have to perfectly execute them. And, you know, it puts businesses and frankly, Maryland residents and ratepayers at a little bit of a disadvantage when it comes to increasing costs in electricity and things like that. So there's so many different policy issues within climate policy that kind of stem off from each other, but that's something that we'll be actively engaged in. We have a lot of members that care about these issues. So more to come.
Yeah. Just kind of thinking, I think some other top ones in my mind that are kind of workforce related, obviously, you know, last year the state passed legalized recreational cannabis, right? And so I think we're going to kind of be watching. We're told that there's going to be a host of other cannabis related bills. I think we'll continue to see how that plays out. And certainly we continue to hear concerns from the business community, their workforce issues, their employment issues. And so we'll be focused on that. I think with such a tight labor market, are going to be more engaged in issues around, let's say, second chance employment.
Mm-hmm.
How do we utilize what is really an untapped workforce and people that were with a criminal background who are looking to reenter the workforce?
Yeah, even those in the addiction recovery, community.
That's another great point. And that's a really important segment of the workforce that when you're struggling to find people, you know, you really got to train and make sure that we can get every single person has a job, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And I think there is going to be some legislation dealing with apprenticeships and the number of apprentices to, let's say, journeymen in this point. And so I think kind of the concern, potentially there's concern there based on like construction trades or skilled trades versus non-construction trade and where that falls. But I think anything we can do to increase the number of apprentices entering a particular job field is really, really important. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, particularly in the construction trades, when there's such a need for let's say transportation projects, we know there's going to be a ton of money from Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act that's going to roll out, and we're going to need the individuals to be there to help to execute on these projects. So,
yeah.
I think we'll see some legislation around that, which will be really important.
I think paid family leave is always top of mind.
Paid
it's something
family leave
you
will
have
to
had the pleasure of working diligently on this summer during the interim. With the Department of Labor, they've been working on the regulations to really build out that program.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that the chamber has provided lots of feedback on and really just been helping to educate our members, especially those smaller and medium-sized businesses that may not know the ins and outs of what to expect. So I think we'll continue to support legislation to bring the program more in line with the federal FMLA program. But ultimately, we'll probably see some bills around it. And I think more outreach and education in general mm-hmm. will continue to see through 2024. I hope we do.
Yeah. Yes, paid family and medical leave. Insurance program obviously has dominated a lot of our time here at the chamber. The Department of Labor is really in the regulatory writing status right now. I think the only major announcement back in October, the department did announce what that total contribution rate would be. For those of you maybe listening who don't know what it is, the department did set a rate of a 0.09%. That means that a contribution of 0.09% of a employee's wages will be paid to the Department of Labor, split evenly between the employer and employee. That is, a rate set by the statute by law, and the split is set by law unless you are a business with less than 15 employees. If you are a business with less than 15 employees, you do not have to make your half of the contribution, but the employee still has to make their half. So that's really the only major announcement. They're supposed to have regulations by January 1 of 24.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that the Department of Labor is going to meet that deadline, but
quickly approaching.
Contributions set to begin October
of
24. Yeah. So, you know, we're 10 months away from businesses beginning to remit, you know, a payroll tax to the Department of Labor. I think that that's that is very, very close. Mm-hmm. And there are lots and lots of questions about how this program is going to work. And so, you know, if you're a business and you're not paying attention to what's going on the paid leave program, pick up the phone and call Hannah, right?
Yeah, I think businesses are itching to just know how the program will work. Will there be an online system like Beacon for UI? How are they going? What's the day-to-day going to look like if an employee, you know, submits an application for leave? So there are a lot of questions, and hopefully we see regulations soon. But also, I think we would urge a delay if needed, if labor needs more time to have solid regulations before rushing through the process just to meet the deadline.
Yeah.
So we'll continue to stay active and engaged in that. And I think really the last big item for us that I can think of is unemployment insurance and UI reform.
Yeah, UI, I think unemployment insurance is going to be, it's going to be a big one. Like you said, we've seen a big bill last year was the first time we saw a big bill, but really since COVID, there has kind of been this call that, hey, something about the UI system needs to be revamped. I think the study done by the Upjohn Institute and released, I don't know, a year and a half ago at this point, it made some calls for changes to the UI system. I don't know that it really identified too many deficiencies in our UI system other than saying we're not bringing enough money in currently. But I think we're seeing a bill, you know, recommending that, well, we bring more money in, but we also send more money out, which, you know, at first glance is not, in my opinion, an adequate solution to a money in problem if you're also sending money out. And so I think as the business community and the funders of this program, you know, we, in a sense, own the program. We need to drive the policy and be smart about it. You know, we need to look at what some of our surrounding states are doing, look at ways to make sure that the program stays usable, it's sustainable, but also doing it in a responsible way. And so I just think that the policy we're seeing kicked around is not necessarily a responsible one. But more to come there. So.
Yeah, well, I think that wraps it up for me. I'm sure we could go into a bunch of different issues that will be involved in this session. But, you know, those are really our top five issues, along with some other big ones out there that we'll be working on.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, we will see plenty that are not anticipated here as it does, and we'll react to those, and our members will get a crack at looking at those and deciding whether or not the chamber should take a position. That's always kind of an exciting part of the legislative session. So I would just say, you know, certainly if you're listening here and you're a member of the chamber, get involved, let us know how you feel about some of these issues. If you're not a member of the chamber, certainly we would love to have you. But if you want to know about our priorities, you can find our legislative priorities document on our website. If you want to sign up to receive advocacy alerts and information from us, you can do all that on our website. Mm-hmm. Sign up for action alerts and get our Friday Five, which is a great weekly newsletter. It's highly read five stories to tell you what's going on.
Yep.
Intersection of business and government.
Keep you updated.
Yeah, other than that, we appreciate you all listening, and more to come. And hopefully we can get some of these good things across the finish line. And for those of us kind of those issues threatening the business climate, we'll beat them back. So.
Definitely. And enjoy your holiday season. Don't think about session too much yet.
Yeah, I know, right. That concludes our in-depth look at the Maryland Chamber's 2024 legislative priorities. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be sure to tune in for future discussions on the issues shaping Maryland's business landscape. We'll see you in the halls.